Coming up, Switzerland in Sound with Bob Zanotti.
Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Welcome to Switzerland in Sound. This is Bob Zanotti. I'm sitting in a lounge in a good hotel in the town of Montreux on the Lake of Geneva. This is not the home of our guest today, but she's here very frequently, and that is one of the days today in Montreux. We're speaking of Margot Kirtikar. I've known Margot for a number of years. Her official residences, in Switzerland anyway, are Lausanne, which is just a few minutes away by train or car here, and Zurich, of course, the metropolis in northern Switzerland. Margot, you have a very, very colorful background. You have a Swiss passport, you have an American passport, but you have Indian, Syrian, and Iraqi blood. In fact, you were born in Baghdad. What do you feel like?
I feel like a citizen of the world. I'm a child of the universe. So I like to say I'm Arab by birth, Swiss by marriage, and American by choice.
You are a spiritual coach and psychoanalyst. You are a writer dealing with spiritual subjects in the genre of personal improvements. Some people would call it New Age. You don't like that term. We'll find out about that in just a moment. You are an artist, and you are a lecturer. You also have your own website. But now let me turn to this question of the New Age. A few years ago, it was the rage. I know you don't like the term New Age, although a lot of people would say that's what she sounds like she's doing. She's a New Age person. Why don't you like the term New Age?
Mainly because it has a negative tonation. People misunderstand what it means, and that's why I don't like to use it.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think people misunderstand about the term New Age? What is negative about it?
Well, the fact is that we are moving from one era of time to another. There are changes. We can see that, we can feel it, we are living it, we are witnessing it on every level. And we are coming to times that are different, to a world that is different to what we have known so far. And this is what one terms as New Age. The negative tonation comes because people misunderstand what it means. They don't like changes. They don't know what it's about.
The human animal doesn't like change. Is that basically true?
Yes, that is very true.
We like our old ways.
Yes. And so I don't like to use it because it turns people off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They see you or categorize you in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But in an objective sense, you don't mind the term New Age. We are in a new age as you see it. And why not identify with this new age? That's what you're really appealing to people to do, to become part of it, to become a New Age activist, to become an active part of this new age.
I like to refer to it as a new world rather than New Age.
Okay, well, at least we've cleared the deck on that particular issue. Let's look again at your background, this multicultural and also multinational background of yours. How did you find your way from the Indian, Syrian, Iraqi scenario here to Switzerland? How did that work?
Maybe you'd like to read my fourth book that I've just completed and will have published soon. And it is about my first two decades, the first two decades of my life, born in Baghdad.
Is that book the one we've discussed on the phone, No. Tears for Baghdad?
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah. 1001 Tears for Baghdad.
That's the final title, 1001 Tears for Baghdad.
That's right, yes. And so from Baghdad, because of the revolution, the whole family moved over to London. In London, I met my husband at the time. He was a student as well, a Swiss.
Swiss, yeah.
Yes, and that's how I ended up in Switzerland.
How did the American passport get in here?
Well, after living here for 15 years, I divorced and I moved over to the States.
And you became a naturalized American.
And after 15 years living in Manhattan, I became a naturalized American, yes. Mm-hmm.
But you didn't stay in New York, as so many people would. They'd say that for them, that's the center of the universe, New York City. You chose to come back to Switzerland. Why did you make that decision?
Well, actually, circumstances forced me to come back to Switzerland. It was not my choice to come back. Mm-hmm. I tried everything, actually, to change it, but I had to come back at the time. It was meant to be.
You would have stayed in New York?
I would have stayed in New York if it was my choice, yes.
What was the reason for wanting to stay in New York if you could?
Because New York is the only city in the world where I really feel at home, actually speaking, because I'm a foreigner everywhere else I go. In New York, everybody is foreign, so I felt at home.
The real melting pot city. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, at some point, if I remember correctly, you were doing rather everyday sort of work. You were working in a bank in Zurich, but all the time you were doing that, you were also studying a great deal. You did a lot of your own personal improvement. You went through it personally, and you came up the hard way. You did all this work on your own in your spare time. You did all your studies up to the PhD level, which you have now for several years, and you decided to go into this field of spiritual coaching and psychoanalysis. What brought you to that decision?
When I came back from New York in 1990, I had gone in New York through 15 years of self-improvement. So when I came back to Switzerland, I realized that they hadn't heard that the movement hasn't happened here yet, hadn't.
Now, you were with someone or doing this on your own in New York?
Well, in New York, self-improvement, self-help, self-development is one of those regular things that one does. One goes weekly to some course or another, yeah. Like you go to the cinema.
They were ahead of things there, as very often is the case.
Absolutely, yes. So when I came back here and realized they were so far behind, I decided that this was my time now to be a trainer, a teacher, and to give workshops and lecture on this.
And these are the studies that you've been doing all the way up to the PhD level.
My PhD is in metaphysics. And I had a practice in Zurich for 10 years where I did psychoanalysis, and I've also studied alternative medicine, Chinese medicine, energy work, yoga, meditation. I do I study the Vedas, and I do meditation work.
Which is the religion of India, so-called Hinduism, but it's the spiritual basis of India.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I remember going back, Margot, it must be the better part of 10 years, to your first book, which mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of reading. Mm-hmm. In fact, you gave me a pre-publication copy to have a look at. Mm-hmm. And it was called You and Change. Mm-hmm. This was a very powerful message about why change is so important to us. It's part of the universe. Mm-hmm. How would you describe that important message?
It has to do with human evolution, self-development, improving your character, your personality, working on yourself. I believe that life is about leaving it better, at a better stage than when you came into life. And this is what life is all about for me.
Life is supposed to be a learning experience, a developmental experience, hence the emphasis today on personal development. You just don't come in here and you go out the way you came in. You're supposed to be the better person for this life experience. That's it in a nutshell, correct?
That's right. And it doesn't have to do with academics. It has to do with the self, with the personality, with your character.
People say, we've had it so good up till now. Look, they change things too much, and then it comes out worse than it was before. How do you answer accusations like that? In other words, promoters of conservatism.
If you look at nature, there is nothing in life that is stagnant and that stays as it is, that doesn't go through the process of change. And therefore, I think that changes are inevitable. One has to move on, one has to change. But that doesn't mean that you change everything. There are certain basic foundations, solid foundations, that one has to build on. And there are things that need change all the time.
For example?
You don't have to uproot yourself and deny your origin and your foundation, where you come from as a human being. But you work on your characteristics, you work on building up and developing virtues and minimizing your vices.
This is personal improvement. That's what it amounts to. Mm-hmm. I think of something that came into my mind. They used to burn witches. They don't do that anymore. This is evolution and social change. We don't believe in doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. There may be witches around, but we don't burn them. This is a concrete example of what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there is a large movement which many people still insist on calling the New Age movement. People who think like you do, like so many others do. We need change. The times, they are a-changing. But if we look at the towers and bastions of political power and economic power, be they the so-called captains of industry or politicians, we see very little willingness to change. We see very little evidence of what we would term enlightenment from the spiritual point of view. It's all me, 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 what's in it for me. The corporation is a living thing. People don't count anymore. All of the mess that we see around us today. How can we be in the midst of a new age, a new world, as you call it, Margot, on the one hand, and still witness all of this misery and suffering based on selfish, old-fashioned egotism on the other? They don't seem to work together.
That's very simple. The media and the focus is on the negative. But at the same time, to balance that on the other side, there's a lot of positive things going on in the world. Unfortunately, the media does not focus on that because it doesn't bring in the money. It doesn't bring them any profit. But if we really look for it, we do find it. There is not only negative things going on around the world, there are also a lot of positive things that are there. We just need to look for them. Now, the enlightenment bit and the people who are right now in the limelight, this is just a passing phase and a part of the whole process of change.
In other words, they're kicking and screaming. They are trying to resist it, but are you saying that ultimately they cannot resist it?
No. Ultimately, they cannot stop the process of the change for things to get better.
You talk about the role of the media, the responsibility of the media in disseminating good or bad news. It's a matter of editorial choice. There was a well-known international radio station based in South America for many, many years. It was actually a Christian station, but it had a very worldly outlook, and they had their own newscast. They would read the world news, and afterward they say, just before they get into the religious message of the day, they'd say, well, that's the news, and now here's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's all a question of perception, isn't it? We choose what we want. If we focus back or zoom away from the macro to the micro, in other words, from the universe and the grand society of which we're only members to the individual self, I guess therein lies the message, Margot, that it all begins with our personal choice of perception and what we choose and choose not to see. Is that basically your field of work?
That is exactly what I do. I deal with the person, with the individual, with the self, with the inner self. And I believe that there is no change that can happen on a macro level without this micro level change happening first.
How can you do this? How can you teach this to people? Obviously, they don't come to you unless they're willing. I assume there must be a willingness, an openness to this to start with. That's point A. But then where does it lead? How does this work in practice, in your practice?
In practice, I don't have any pre-programmed training program for anybody. I deal with every individual on the level that they are on. And when they come to me, I listen first and then work with them in accordance with what their need is.
What are some of the common problems that you face in people today?
Most of the people who come to me are those who feel lost.
Disorientation, this sort of thing.
Disorientation, yes. And they might have everything. They have their health, they have their private life okay, they have their jobs, they have their income, and yet they feel a loss. They feel a hole somewhere in their chest area that they can't fill. They feel a dissatisfaction. Those are the type of people who come to me. Or, on the other hand, the ones who are having personal problems with their work or their partners.
The old burnout syndrome, this sort of thing, they come to you?
Yes. Burnout, I don't know about burnout, it's just that they feel dissatisfied and they are looking for guidance.
Where does this emptiness come from? What's the cause of it?
In a few words, from my point of view, it's the disconnection with the soul, the disconnection with the inner self. That's where it comes from.
How does this happen?
Disconnection with the divine, the inner self, the soul, it comes through focusing and living on the material level, on the physical material level, which is the lowest level of existence.
The new car, the new refrigerator, the new house, that expensive vacation, the big cruise in the Caribbean, this will make you happy. And you're saying it doesn't. It's a very short-lived thing.
That's right. That's exactly what I mean.
Well, what can people do about this?
Well, the thing is that they have to take time to be in touch with their inner self. The same as you need time to enjoy everything else, you need time to spend with yourself also. And once you can do that on a regular basis, on a regular daily basis, even for only a few minutes a day, you can see a difference there. You can feel a difference.
So in other words, if more and more people learned to embrace change and improve themselves individually, the number of these people will get bigger and bigger, and eventually it will, like quantum physics, it will just take over everything and change our whole way of living, our whole collective society. That's the simple theory, is it correct?
Yes, that's right.
How long will it take for this to happen? Many of us are waiting and praying and hoping for it to happen as soon as possible, but we see a lot of ugly things going on today in this world.
Rather than praying and hoping and watching and waiting, I would say that if everyone tried to work on themselves on a positive level, to self-improve, then you will see the movement happening much faster.
But what about these captains of industry? What about the politicians who make all of the decisions which so often lead to the misery of so many people? They don't seem to be getting the message.
Well, the process there is that everything has to take its time and go its own process. And there is nothing that you or me can do about it right now. Actually, what is happening is that, contrary to how it used to be in the past, when anybody did anything bad, it took months, sometimes years, for the people to find out, to realize what is happening. In today's world, we can see what is happening within a minute, worldwide, millions. And that in itself is a big change, I think.
I think of a famous quotation. I may not have it absolutely one-to-one here, but this is in essence what he said, a quotation from Abraham Lincoln. He said, "You can fool all of the people some of the time. Mm-hmm. You can fool some of the people all of the time, but you can never fool all of the people all of the time." And that's basically what you're saying. The more people that we have in numbers who are getting wise to what this world is all about, mm-hmm. improving themselves, the fewer and fewer gullible people we're going to have. In a way, it also boils down to education, not necessarily in the classroom context, although that's important, but education from the point of view of who am I, what am I doing here, what is my real purpose in life. This is where you're at home, Margot Kittikar.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And who takes advantage of this, this access to the deeper meaning of life, this education that you're offering, and so many other people in this field too? Who are these students of yours?
Anybody and everybody from all walks of life and on any level who is searching and looking for something better, a better quality of life.
But isn't it true that if you are in a difficult situation, that this might provoke or trigger an interest that you didn't have before? Let's say you're going through hell at the office, you want to get out of there, you're looking for some way out, somebody to help you to understand why this insanity is happening. They come to you. This is a good time in life, isn't it? These are good circumstances to improve and to pull yourself further.
Well, usually what I believe is that obstacles and problems in life do happen to prod you onto this path of self-discovery.
There's no such thing as bad luck. I mean, every cloud has a silver lining. Everything that happens to us, even though it might be painful or miserable, is positive and a chance to grow if you look at it from that point of view.
Yes, there is no such thing as bad luck and no such thing as coincidence.
Many of us, if not most of us, if we look around our world today, are getting very impatient with the stupidity, the ignorance, the terrorism, the murder, the killing, the senseless suffering that goes on, the poverty. We're all asking the same question: when is this better time going to occur? I mean, you say you see signs of it happening. There are people coming to you. There are others like you working all over the world. There's a great interest in this self-improvement, spiritual development, and so on. But do you have any idea when, I mean, it's a serious question. I mean, any idea when we're going to start seeing better times?
I'll give you a serious answer to that. The moment every one of these people who think in that fashion stop thinking in that fashion and concentrate more on how to improve the self and make one's environment into a better place to live in, that's the way you contribute to your own environment. And stop concentrating on when it's the senseless that there isn't they, the bad ones, are going to stop that.
You mentioned four books, your latest one being 1001 Tears for Baghdad. We will get into that in a moment. What about the missing books, 2 and 3? What are those titles?
In my second book, which is titled Visions Unusual, I condense information about metaphysics into this one book to explain to the layman what metaphysics is all about. And rather than having people jumping from one area to another and concentrating on and not knowing what to concentrate on, I give them an all-round view of what metaphysics is all about so that they can better choose and understand.
So it's an orientation in what is metaphysics. It's a term we've heard so often, but many of us really are not sure what it means. So it's an elongated definition then, what it is and what it isn't.
Yes, that's right.
And book number three?
Number three is a list of universal cosmic laws that exist. I think I collected over more than 15 years work goes into this book. And this is a list of cosmic laws. I think I have about 260 of them altogether, and I know that I don't have all of them. And basically it explains every law. These are natural laws that if you understand them, you can better the quality of your life. Because there are many things in nature that if we work against, will naturally go against us. So understanding these laws, basic laws, is very important.
And now book number four, it sounds like a rather political book, but also something very emotional, 1001 Tears for Baghdad. You were born in Baghdad, so maybe you in your own words can describe the emotion and the motivation behind that book.
I was brought up, raised in Baghdad in the 40s and 50s, and these are two decades that are referred to by Iraqis as the two golden decades, the golden age era of Baghdad.
In what sense?
It was when Baghdad was booming, Iraq was booming. And everything was going well. It was the monarchy, and people lived, foreigners as well as natives and locals lived in Baghdad. They worked and mingled together. There was no religious-wise, racist-wise. It was just a very good time to live in Baghdad.
Like Lebanon of the good old days as well, where it was called the Paris of the Orient.
That's right. And also Persia, Tehran, before the Shah was...
Oil money was flowing too, let's be honest.
That's right. That's right. And so I think this era has been forgotten. And what is very interesting also, although there have been books written, there is nothing political about my book. It's more personal, and it's more an introduction to the reader as to how life was and how it could be again in Baghdad. And since I was brought up as a Christian, it's also an unusual way of looking at it, at the Arab world from a Christian point of view, from a young girl's life.
Well, obviously the thing that dominates the talk of Iraq today is not Christianity, unless you're a potential missionary, of course, but the real issue is Islam and what people see as an inseparable connection, a deep, intimate connection between Islam and terrorism and murder. I mean, you knew the way Baghdad was, and you look at it today. How do you feel about all of this, what's going on today?
Well, that's exactly what prompted me to write my book. That's why I call it 1001 Tears, because it's very, very sad. The other issue that I underline in my book is that not all Arabs are Muslims. There are also Christian Arabs, and not all Muslims are terrorists. And so I'm bringing in a point of view to introduce the Christian Arabs, actually, in my book, yeah.
A very interesting point. You talk about personal improvement, personal development, spiritual development and guidance. I have personally interviewed, I've read, and I've heard so much being said about what Islam is and what Islam is not. And people say over and over, Islam is not a violent religion or a religion of violence. It's people who misunderstand it. Well, where, Margot, does this misunderstanding come from? Why do people commit such atrocities in the name of religion? In this specific case, Islam. They're doing a disservice to the religion, it seems.
Yes, but so did the Christians so many centuries ago. It's exactly the same thing. It's ignorant.
Crusades and this sort of thing?
That's right. It's ignorant people who take over power, and people give them this power, obviously, and they misuse it.
Why, in the cradle of so much religious thinking, the Middle East, do we have so much violence and hatred and bloodshed at this moment? What went wrong there?
I don't think that I'm in a position to give answers to this. But if you look back, I mentioned this in my book, for example, in the 1000. I have a short paragraph relating to this about the 20th century, how it started in the Middle East. The British went over to Iraq because they wanted oil. They invaded Iraq. They put the monarchy there. But the oil profits were divided between the foreigners. Not 1 cent of that went to the natives, the Iraqis. And that's how the beginning of the 20th century started. Now, how do you think they feel about that? And also, what is happening with Israel and Palestine in the 40s, when Israel was established in the Middle East, they took over homes of the Palestinians. The Palestinians were just told to pack their bags and leave. And they became refugees, their homes taken from them and their land taken from them. And it hasn't stopped since.
This is the whole source of the tension we have today in that area.
This is one major basic tension. Yes.
Yeah.
What I would like to say is that if the people were left to themselves to live alone, together, without the politicians interfering, the Israelis, the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live together, whether Shiites or Sunnis or whoever, whatever. They can and do want to live together in peace. It's the politicians and everybody else who's power hungry and looking for profits who's interfering in this wish for peace.
People holding on to isms rather than their humanism.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Margot Kittikar, spiritual coach, psychotherapist, metaphysician, writer, artist, lecturer. I think one thing we can conclude, indeed a fascinating woman and a longtime resident of Switzerland, shares her residence between Lausanne and Zurich, Switzerland's largest city. Margot, thanks very much for being with us and telling us about what you do and some of your philosophy. From Montreux on the Lake of Geneva, for Switzerland in Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.